the new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator,
relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him? I hit him.
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
It took 6 weeks for the prosecution to present its case against Karen Reed in her retrial. As a comparison, the first trial called 68 witnesses during 29 days. Trial 2 was 38 witnesses in 23 days. There were some noticeably absent witnesses this time around, like Brian Albert and Brian Higgins, and probably the most glaringly obvious absent witness, former trooper Michael Proctor. Hank Brennan attempted to streamline the prosecution's case by only calling the witnesses that he felt necessary and trying to keep out any of the witnesses that he knows may actually benefit the defense. It's now time for the defense to present their evidence to the jury. But before they even get started on that, defense attorney Alan Jackson files a motion to dismiss the case, arguing that the prosecution has not even proven that there was a collision on January 29th, 2022 at 34 Fairview Road. Jackson points out there were no eyewitnesses and no video, audio, or physical evidence in any form. He says the Commonwealth sought to prove that the SUV went backwards, but every single expert witness acknowledged that none of the data shows any kind of collision. Brennan argued that Karen Reed was intoxicated. There were taillight pieces found in John O'Keefe's clothing, and Karen said that she found him the next morning around where she expected to find him. He also argues that the arm injuries are consistent with a taillight injury and says there is overwhelming evidence of a collision. And Karen, driving forward and then backwards, shows intentional conduct and that a reasonable person could find that conduct created a strong likelihood of death. After arguments were made for each side, the judge immediately denied the defense's motion, which was expected. And with that, it's time for the defense to present their case. The purpose of a prosecution's case is to present the evidence that they have that proves, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant committed the crime as charged. During the Commonwealth's case, the defense will use cross-examination to scrutinize and poke holes in their evidence, including reports or testimony, any inconsistencies or potential bias, basically anything showing any kind of weakness in their case and the evidence being presented. And while cross-examination is a great time to poke holes and show weakness in the Commonwealth's evidence, the defense's case in chief is where they get the chance to bring in their own evidence and their own witnesses. Different evidence, witnesses, experts, reports, they get to present relevant information that challenges the prosecution's case and gives the jury something else to consider. But it's important to remember the defense doesn't have to prove anything. The burden of proof lies solely on the prosecution. The defense doesn't even have to put on a defense if they choose not to. But when they do, it's for the sole purpose of establishing reasonable doubt. So, have they been able to do that? Let's take a look at how the first week went for the defense. The prosecution closed out its case with a crash reconstruction expert, and the defense chose to start theirs with an expert of their own to challenge that. Matthew DeSogra is an accident reconstructionist engineer and specializes in vehicle data and data recorders. He was hired by the defense to look at Aperture's reports and clarify them for the defense. The first one is Shannon Burgess's first report. He says Burgess basically looked at the clock variance from Karen Reed's SUV and John O'Keefe's phone, and then gave multiple approaches on how to align the clocks. Burgess didn't actually go through with the calculations here. He just noted some different data that you could potentially compare to figure out this time difference. For example, the calls on John O'Keefe's phone and the time that they lined up with the Bluetooth in the car. So DeSogra took the different ways that Burgess proposed to align the clocks and actually just did those calculations. But DeSogra said that with every single possibility, no matter which adjustments were made in any combination, that the time John O'Keefe locked his phone by hitting the side button was always after the time that the Commonwealth is saying that Karen Reed had hit him. Now, obviously, this is a problem for the Commonwealth. So, now comes Burgess later on with a new report, where he basically says, scrap all of that other data, and instead, let's compare it to this three-point turn. So he does that instead, and this time, instead of giving ways to align the clocks, he goes through with the calculations based on just that data. And now the time variance has shifted and can include the possibility of impact after John O'Keefe hits the lock button on his phone. But apparently, when you consider all the variances, there are 30 possible options and only 3 that fit the time frame. Jackson points out that this is only a 10% possibility, and Hank objected to that being said, and it was sustained, but the number is out there now for the jury. DeSogra also confirms that there's no collision history showing on any of the data, and the trigger events don't record that. Now, DeSogra is the defense's first witness, so when he's done with direct testimony, we got our first example of what prosecutor Hank Brennan is going to be like on cross-examination. And it's very on brand for Hank Brennan based on what we've seen from him in pretrial hearings and arguments. The way that Brennan was on cross with DeSogra is a theme and temperament that we saw from him the entire week. He does this thing with witnesses where he'll ask them a series of questions that are completely unrelated to what they were hired to do. We saw this when Dr. Russell was on the stand and Brennan asked her about a dog bite class that she informed him does not exist. This is a tactic for Brennan to make it seem like the defense's witness didn't complete work or didn't have the complete story. But asking about things that someone wasn't hired to do really doesn't impact a witness's effectiveness. Another thing we saw Brennan do repeatedly this week was getting a fact wrong and then trying to just kind of glide past it after he realizes it. We saw him do this during the ARCA motions when he told the judge that the feds gave information instead of the defense. And we saw it when he made a snarky comment about Yannetti being on court TV, when in reality it was a Zoom hearing. A court appearance, not a media appearance. And we saw it the moment he began his first cross-examination against DeSogra. Brennan began asking DeSogra about the tech stream data, specifically about acceleration being a trigger event. In other words, acceleration would be recognized by the car, and then the car would be triggered to record the data for 5 seconds before and after it hit that mark. Now, when Brennan was asked about this, he specifically mentioned 30%. And DeSogra explains that the only way that regular acceleration would be recorded as a trigger event is if the car is pre-collision. And he's right, the car doesn't record any and all acceleration. To use a line from Dr. Welcher, that question doesn't make any sense. What Brennan meant to ask is that when acceleration pedal is pressed down 30%, does that cause the trigger? And even though Brennan was wrong about this in his questioning, he had the audacity to say this to the expert.
Are you sure you know a lot about tech stream data?
Yes.
Objection.
Sustained.
Do you know a lot about tech stream data?
Yes.
Brennan continued his passive-aggressive comments during questioning a few more times during DeSoger's cross, like when he asked about when he sent his updated presentation to the defense.
They had a copy of your PowerPoint on May 25th. Don't be shy.
No, I'm pretty sure it was the 25th.
So sustained.
Don't be shy? Really? But the comment that was probably the worst and most disrespectful, in my opinion, when he asked DeSoger about data in the report that he had analyzed and where it came from.
The assumption is if the vehicle has a timestamp and the phone wasn't connected, it would have been synchronized after the fact. But that wasn't tested. And that's... Aperture didn't do any of that testing in their work to look at the behavior of a timestamp in the infotainment when a phone is synchronized after the fact.
Blaming Aperture is not going to get you out of answering the question.
Sustained.
Sure.
Despite all of this, DeSoger definitely held his own. When Brennan pushed him about his analysis of Aperture's reports, Brennan asked if he had made assumptions on it. And this was DeSoger's response.
I am looking at what Dr. Welcher put in his trial presentation. And my assumption that's baked in there is that he's going to stand behind the things he says in a presentation. So I'm taking them at face value, but as being correct.
Also during DeSoger's testimony, the issue of the chip and missing data was brought up. And Brennan questioned him on it. DeSoger saw in the report where Burgess thought that there was more information on the chip because the size of it was so big. And he pulled the data sheets to specify the size and realized Burgess's mistake. So DeSoger told the defense about it. And in an affidavit, he said, basically, Burgess has the size of the chip wrong. There's no need to bother with another chip off. But when Brennan brought this up, it seemed like he was asking DeSoger if he was saying, no need to worry about another chip-off, as if he was trying to hide information. Ultimately, no additional information was found on that chip or any other. But Burgess did see an SD card that had been previously overlooked, which is where some of the new data came from. Now, DeSoger was with Burgess when they were supposed to be looking at the SUV for any other chips available. So Brennan asked him about Burgess finding this SD card.
What's not a matter of guessing. There was nothing in there about that prior to that.
Did it offend you, or you were impressed that he had found that?
I was a little confused because I went into it with an expectation. Generally, if we write a protocol, we adhere to the protocol. If we're going to deviate, we have a discussion about deviations. So I was just surprised. It's not customary to sort of shift out of nowhere. But other than that, I did not know what to think of it because I'd never heard of that.
It seemed pretty obvious that Brennan was trying to make the expert look bad. He made comments that DeSoger didn't do any of his own work and just criticized someone else's. And overall, the aggression that Brennan directed at this witness just felt really uncalled for. I think defense attorney Alan Jackson kind of wanted to protect his expert, and he snapped back a little bit. He asked DeSoger about his education on redirect. And while DeSoger may have had no clue what this line of questioning was about, we all know that this is kind of in response to the disaster of Shannon Burgess.
Were you being truthful when you indicated that you have a certain expertise in EDR data?
Yes.
Were you being truthful when you indicated that you did review Mr. Burgess's data and Mr. Welcher's data as reflected in their reports and PowerPoints?
Yes.
Were you being truthful about your credentials?
Yes.
Have you ever lied about your credentials?
No.
You hold a bachelor's degree?
Yes.
And you hold a master's degree?
I do.
You ever lied to anybody about that?
No.
Jackson and Brennan went back and forth a few more times with DeSoger and argued mainly over the idea that DeSoger's analysis was based solely off of Burgess and Welcher's. So basically, the entire analysis of the defense expert was based on the data from the prosecution's experts. So if anything was wrong in DeSoger's report, it was because something was wrong with theirs. Now, one person who was noticeably absent from the prosecution's witness list, but very important for the defense, is former trooper Michael Proctor. Now, in any criminal case, one could expect the lead investigator to be called by the prosecuting side. But given Proctor's storied history, The Commonwealth didn't call him. Proctor is important to the defense's case because it will help them prove bias in the investigation. Because he wasn't called, the defense has done two things. First, they filed a missing witness instruction, which basically means they're asking the judge to tell the jury that if the Commonwealth doesn't call a witness who was, one, available, and two, otherwise expected to be helpful to their side, and three, there's no good reason for not calling them, then the jury can assume that that witness would have actually said something damaging to the prosecution's case. The judge has not yet made a ruling on this motion. They also strategically introduced evidence about Proctor through other witnesses, specifically his offensive texts. To introduce these texts, defense first held a voir dire to argue their point. They made the case that Proctor's texts show his state of mind during the investigation. The prosecution said that the defense should just bring Proctor in, even though they didn't. Defense attorney David Unetti was clearly annoyed with Brennan's suggestion on how to run his case.
I would note Mr. Brennan is not sitting at defense counsel table in this case. We appreciate the offer to help us with strategy about which witness we should call, but that's solely the province of the defense to determine which witness we want to use to authenticate and admit text messages. That's our choice, and we should not be deprived of that choice because Mr. Brennan thinks there's a better witness that should have introduced the text messages. There is no rule. There's no best witness rule in this case. I believe my co-counsel has already made that argument in another circumstance.
So the judge ruled in favor of the defense to bring these texts in, with a few redactions, including the mention of Boston Police Department Internal Affairs. As a reminder, that text said, quote, "I can only imagine what internal affairs at the BPD are trying to get out there," end quote. Now, to introduce the text through a witness, Unetti calls Jonathan Diamandis to the stand, a longtime friend of Proctor who had been in a group text with him and some of their other friends. Diamandis verified the text on Unetti's direct, but on cross, Brennan decided he wanted to try to get ahead of the entire issue of Proctor and bias by having Diamandis, who is a likable guy, read these texts verbatim. And he read a few, but when he got to the really offensive ones, he didn't want to continue.
Could you read all of them, please?
These are not my words. I'm not really comfortable reading these. Do I have to say these words out loud?
So I'm going to see you at sub.
After a sidebar, Brennan, in a strange and awkward move, decided to read the text himself. Again, I think he was wanting to take some of the sting out of this.
Mr. Proctor says, from all accounts, he didn't do a thing wrong. She's a whack job, and then uses the C word to describe. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
And one person in the group says, no ass bitch. Accurate?
Yes, that's accurate.
Mr. Proctor, there's a response, laughed at, quote, no ass bitch.
Yes.
Somebody in the group says, is that chick a smoke? And then the same person follows up with a question mark. Accurate?
Accurate.
Mr. Proctor responds, eh, E-H?
Yes.
Nut bag, as my chief would say?
Yes.
She's got a leaky balloon knot?
Yes.
Leaks poo?
Yes.
Are those the words of Mr. Proctor?
They are.
Did I read those accurately?
You did.
Brennan reading the text definitely didn't have the same impact as having Proctor on the stand last year, having to read his vile words out loud himself, including the C word, and making fun of Karen Reed's medical conditions. But the jury still did hear those words. But one of the most heartbreaking and infuriating moments of this whole thing was Brennan reading a text that may not have been made public before. That text was in regards to John O'Keefe's sister who passed away and that her husband, quote, OD'd on her grave, end quote. John O'Keefe's brother-in-law died of a heart attack, but it may not have been public information that it was caused by an overdose. John O'Keefe's niece and nephew have been through enough after losing both of their parents and then their uncle who became their legal guardian. This text was intentionally left out of the previous trial, and it should have been left out of this one. This moment was terrible, and it's kind of unforgivable, in my opinion. Diamandis was also questioned about Proctor being fired. Now, Brennan tried to minimize this topic. Like, he mentioned a few times that Proctor was fired for these texts, making it sound like Proctor lost his job because he sent a few gross text messages. But it's a lot bigger than that. And it's not even just the text, but what those texts show, including his state of mind and bias. But Jannetty cleared this up. He read from the actual report about why Proctor had been fired, including the bias and conduct unbecoming an officer. Overall, Proctor's texts do show his state of mind during the investigation, and it shows that he was biased and had sort of made up his mind about Karen Reed, and he thought really poorly of her. All things that are important for the jury to see. But overall, it's really unfortunate that they had to be brought in at all, especially for John O'Keefe's niece and nephew to have to hear. Although the defense didn't call Proctor to the stand, they did call a different law enforcement officer who was working the night that John O'Keefe died. Kelly Dever was an officer with the Canton Police Department in 2022. She came in for Sergeant Good on January 28th and worked into overtime that night. During the late hours of her shift, she was working in dispatch. And what's interesting about Dever is that no one from the Canton Police Department or the Massachusetts State Police talked to her during their investigation. In fact, it was the feds that spoke to her first, in August of 2023. And her statement? Well, take a listen.
Did you tell these law enforcement officers that you, in fact, saw Brian Higgins and Chief Berkowitz go into the Sallyport with the
Objection.
SUV? May I finish my question?
He can finish this question. It's okay. Go ahead.
Did you tell those law enforcement agents on August 9th, 2023, that you saw Brian Higgins and Chief Berkowitz go into the Sallyport together and alone with the SUV for a wildly long time?
That was my recollection at the time.
So you did say that?
At the time, that is what I recollected.
Okay.
Prior to the first trial, the defense contacted Dever about this statement to the feds and wanted her to testify on it. Now, this is the point where Dever's story started to change.
Did you also say on that phone call something to the effect of, I know you're going to tear me a new one because I'm changing my testimony?
Changing, no, but you're trying to do that.
Did you say, I know you're going to tear me a new one?
That's what you're trying to do, so yes.
She knew the defense would be upset that her story was changing from one that fit their argument to one that didn't. And on the stand during this trial, she said the defense team got mad and threatened her with perjury.
They were looking for me to say that I saw Higgins and Berkowitz in the garage with the car.
Did you share with them that that wasn't an accurate memory?
Yes.
How did they respond?
They became very aggressive, raised their voices, and the one word that I can very definitely remember is they said that they would charge me with perjury.
While on the stand, Jackson says to Dever that no one threatened her with perjury, and this was her response.
Have you ever seen a defense attorney charge anybody with a crime?
So you can seek out reporting someone for it.
Have you ever seen a defense attorney charge someone with a crime, ma'am?
Personally, no.
Right. Fact of the matter is, nobody ever threatened you with perjury, did they?
Oh, they did, yes. I contacted the FBI regarding it.
Did you?
I did.
You have a report?
I have an email conversation where I sent the two questions I had. She responded, I will pass these along. I was contacted by their legal team. They reassured me perjury was not applicable because I made a statement in good faith. Upon further information, I retracted it, corrected it, and made it clear that I could no longer say it because I knew that it was not a clear reflection of the events that took place.
That's a mouthful.
Yes.
My question is, do you have a report from the FBI saying that you reported that someone on the Karen Reed defense team threatened to charge you, your words, with perjury?
No.
Have a report to that effect?
No.
No.
So Dever says to the feds that she saw Higgins and Chief Berkowitz go into the Sallyport alone with Karen Reed's car for a wildly long time. And she thought that that was weird because of Higgins being present the night that John O'Keefe was killed. And he was now in there with crucial evidence. It stood out to her. But She says that she changed her story because she realized that it couldn't be true because she wasn't there and it was just a false memory. And while Dever may not be sure of her memories, one thing that she did make sure of during her testimony is that Jackson was going to get her name right. She didn't want to be there. She was frustrated. Didn't seem like she cared for Jackson much. And she corrected him on how he said her name rather rudely multiple times.
Mr. Cox told you, number one, the Boston Police Department supports you. And Officer Dever, do the right thing.
So he said my name correctly. He said Dever. And
that's my mistake. Let's see. You want me to repeat the question so I get it right?
So, Mr. Jackson, let's go ahead and answer, please.
You can't remember my name. I don't remember.
I can remember your name, Miss Dever.
Okay, so the answer is I don't remember. No comments.
More than that, Judge. I think we all.
All right. So no comments. Question. Just questions, please.
However, it was that Jackson pronounced her name. He made sure to introduce the point that the commissioner, the head of the police department, called Dever into his office to tell her to, quote-unquote, do the right thing in regards to her testimony and correcting the statement that she made to the feds. Jackson got Dever to say that her entire job revolves around what she says on the witness stand, and that if she lies on the stand, she loses her job. Changing her story or having a false memory after swearing to the feds that it was true, could certainly impact her credibility, not only in this case, but in future ones as well. And speaking of credibility, the defense's next expert witness is undoubtedly credible. I've covered Dr. Russell in previous episodes because she now has had two voir dires and testified during the last trial. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time going through her massive amount of experience, but here's the Cliff's Notes version. Dr. Russell had been a board-certified emergency doctor and a board-certified forensic pathologist for more than 30 years. She has tons of experience and interest in dog bites and their wound patterns. Now, during the first trial, Dr. Russell gave her opinion on the wounds of John O'Keefe's arm. Lally questioned these opinions, so for this trial, Dr. Russell spent more time studying the topic and honed in on her opinion for this specific case. She didn't change her testimony, but she did get much more specific with it. On direct, Dr. Russell testified that based on a pattern recognition and a differential diagnosis, the marks on John O'Keefe's arm were caused by a dog attack.
Do you have an opinion as to what caused these injuries?
Yes, I believe that these injuries are the result of dog bites and or claw marks.
And do you hold that opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
On cross, Brennan spent most of his time trying to discredit Russell by saying that she changed her testimony, which simply isn't true. And we see Brennan again becoming aggressive and disrespectful, like when he asked Dr. Russell this.
You have any memory issues?
No.
Dr. Russell was visibly offended here and seemed honestly just disappointed that Brennan would go that low. Brennan also grilled her on the sequestration order and if she'd spoken to Alessi the night after her first day on the stand. Now, here's the backstory on that. During Dr. Russell's first day, Brennan referenced things from a transcript that actually weren't in the transcript. And I don't know if this was an attempt to trip her up or something else completely, but Alessi advised Russell that night to ask for a transcript during Brennan's questioning. Now, under a sequestration order, people involved in the case, like an expert witness, are not allowed to talk about it outside of the courtroom. In this instance, however, Brennan wasn't being fully truthful with his line of questioning, so I can understand why Alessi would want to protect his witness, especially because she was trusting Brennan's words. Here's Brennan commenting on the violation.
May I see the transcript?
Of course. Pursuant to Attorney Alessi's advice, let me approach.
Objection, Your Honor.
I'm going to strike that. Disregard that, Judge.
Aside from comments like that, he also accused Dr. Russell of interjecting herself into the trial, saying, quote, "you definitely want to be in this case," end quote. Brennan's behavior could backfire, though. Prosecutors are held to high standards, and Brennan's aggressive nature could come across as bullying. Will the jurors see this as an impact to the right to a fair trial? Is it fair when a jury sees a prosecutor making comments that he knows he's not supposed to be making? Time will tell. Now, continuing on, Dr. Russell spent a good amount of time going over the individual wounds on John O'Keefe's arm and continually explains pattern recognition. Oftentimes, you can't determine the cause of an individual wound, but it's the collection of wounds that would lead to the determination. And then Brennan does something that triggers an objection, a sidebar, and a request for a mistrial.
On the right arm, there were a number of different tears in that fabric that you looked at, weren't there?
Yes, there were a number of small round holes in that
You're fabric. You're aware, aren't you, that those holes were swabbed for traces of dog DNA.
Objection, Your Honor. I'd like to approach, please.
Okay, come on up.
So here's why this is an issue. The Commonwealth has already rested their case. They cannot introduce new evidence, and the jury can't consider facts that aren't in evidence. It's misleading to make the jury think that there was no dog DNA found on John O'Keefe's arm wounds because his arm wounds weren't swabbed, and his shirt was swabbed, but it's unknown exactly where, and it tested positive for inhibitors, aka things that could reduce the amplification of DNA. Alessi gets up and, in a very fiery tone, motions for a mistrial with prejudice. He argues that Brennan brought the concept of DNA in on Russell's cross intentionally and in open court in front of the jury.
The defense moves strongly, vigorously for a mistrial with prejudice. A mistrial with prejudice.
Alessi argued that there was no mention of dog DNA in regards to what Brennan has raised, and that the defense has been meticulous about not mentioning DNA either directly or indirectly. Alessi said that the idea of DNA has been put in the jury's mind, and that's something that cannot be fixed with a jury instruction. The only remedy would be for the judge to declare a mistrial. Now, Brennan opposed these ideas and said that inquiring about the absence of dog DNA is proper and permissible, and that the prosecution is entitled to explore these theories and facades that the defense brings up. He said they didn't bring it up on cross, but that doesn't mean it's beyond the scope on cross. Now, Brennan also accused Dr. Russell of being an advocate for the defense. Now, Judge Cannone denied the motion for a mistrial. And that's not too surprising, but what is surprising is that somehow she let the line of dog DNA questioning continue, which is wild to me. This also shifts the burden of proof to the defense and basically shows that Brennan can say whatever he wants without evidence having been entered, and the judge is allowing it. After the mistrial arguments, Brennan questioned Dr. Russell a bit more, and his disrespect continued right up until the very end. He asked her a question and proceeded to walk to his table and take a seat while she was still answering. Unbelievable. This week, we also heard from Officer Nicholas Barrows from the Dighton Police Department. Now, Barrows has no connections to anyone from the Canton Police Department or Massachusetts State Police, and he became involved in the case because of his jurisdiction. He was called to Karen's parents' house on the afternoon of January 29th to help Massachusetts State Police seize Karen's SUV. Barrows was brought in to testify last year by the prosecution, and he said that he saw Karen's rear taillight when he was at her parents' house in Dighton. His testimony was that it was cracked with a piece missing, but it wasn't completely damaged. Now, this aligned with the defense's case, so they didn't cross-examine him. But this year, the prosecution did not call Barrows, so the defense did. And Barrows' story has never changed. His original report said that the taillight was cracked with a piece missing and that it wasn't completely damaged. The defense showed Barrows a photo of what Karen's taillight looked like while it was inside the Sallyport, and this was his response.
Do you see what's depicted in this photograph?
I do.
What does that appear to be, just generally?
The right rear taillight.
Of what?
The Lexus SUV.
Is that consistent with the black Lexus SUV that you saw at the Reed residence?
That was the black Lexus. That was not the taillight the day I was there.
Sergeant Barrows, is this the condition of the right rear taillight when you showed up at the Reed household at around 3:15 in the afternoon on January 29th, 2022?
Absolutely not.
Jackson also asked what was different about the taillight and what it looked like when he saw it at the Reed's house.
What's different about this photo, sir?
That taillight is completely smashed out.
On cross, Brennan showed a still shot from the dash cam footage of the police cruiser from the morning of January 29th when they went to do a wellness check at John O'Keefe's house. Now, Karen's SUV is in the frame, but it's hard to make out the taillight given the pixelated footage and the snow. But in the end, Barrows says that that's what the taillight looked like when he saw it later in the day. Brennan then asked Barrows about his testimony from last year. He asked if he'd seen the photo of Karen's taillight when it was in the Sallyport, and he confirmed he had. He also asked if he had made the distinction that the photo was different from what he saw at Karen's parents' house, something that Barrows also confirmed. Brennan then tries a gotcha moment where he shows a transcript from last year's trial, because that statement that Barrows said he made isn't in there. And Brennan uses this as grounds for saying that Barrows has memory problems. And guess what? Barrows said he did have a hard time remembering what he did or didn't say in court last year. But he insisted he knows what he saw that day. This isn't really a win for Brennan, so he then resorts to two things. First, he insinuated that the defense is doing something shady. Jackson and Barrows had met together at a hotel conference room where Jackson was staying because Jackson doesn't have an office in the Boston area. So they met there in that conference room, and Brennan tried to make it into something weird and nefarious in his line of questioning to Barrows. Brennan also resorted to being utterly disrespectful to this officer. For example, Jackson objected to a question that Brennan asked, and Barrows looked over at Jackson. Judge Canoni overruled this objection, and then Brennan had the audacity to say, "Over here," to redirect Barrows' attention toward him. He's literally calling him like he's a dog. This is wild to me. As they're walking to the sidebar, you can hear Jackson repeat what Brennan had just said. It sounds like he's shocked that Brennan had that level of disrespect.
Face me, what'd you talk about?
Objection,
huh? I'm going to allow it.
Over here. What'd you talk about?
Excuse me.
So that, okay.
Over here.
And reporter Jessica Machado said that right after this interaction, when the sidebar was called, she saw Brennan smirk at a woman that was sitting in front of her with the O'Keefe family. And the woman, you can see her in the footage smile back as she sipped her water. This woman is somebody who John O'Keefe dated many, many years ago. The whole interaction was just so disrespectful. But regardless of the disrespect, the jury heard this witness testify that the condition of the taillight in the Sallyport is not how he saw it earlier in the day. And that's a big moment for the defense. And now to one of my favorite witnesses of all time, Brian Lucky Loughran, the snowplow driver. A little bit of background on Lucky. He's lived in Canton his entire life. His brother is on the select board with Chris Albert. Lucky also used to deliver pizzas for Chris Albert's pizza place for 8 years. He testified the last trial and was a fan favorite. People love Lucky because he comes across as just an honest, hardworking, genuine man.
Now, when you are plowing, sir, where is your attention focused?
My attention is focused out the front window, to the right and to the left.
Why?
I am looking for pedestrians. I'm looking for residents that may be backing out, not aware that I'm there, and God forbid, animals.
While on the stand, Lucky talked about his Franken truck, a plow truck with extra parts added on, like the extra bright lights that give great visibility and act almost as spotlights. Lucky's direct testimony was important for two reasons. First, When he drove the plow truck by 34 Fairview at 2:30 a.m., he saw nobody on the lawn. And remember, he has basically like spotlights on his truck.
Now, as you were passing 34 Fairview, could you see the area of the flagpole at 2:45 in the morning, sir?
Yes.
What was on the ground on the Albert's lawn at that point in the area of the flagpole?
Nothing.
Did you see a 6'1", 216-pound man lying on that lawn?
No.
Then when he drove by about an hour later, there was a Ford Edge parked by the flagpole where John O'Keefe was eventually found.
Describe for the jury what you see in the road at that point.
As I make my right onto Fairview, I notice that there's a vehicle on the right-hand side roughly in the area of the flagpole in front of 34 Fairview.
Okay. And did you make note of what type of vehicle that was?
Yes.
What type of vehicle was that?
A Ford Edge.
Lucky said he noticed the car because he knows the Alberts. He's known them for years, and they never park on the street. Also, it's against city ordinance to park on the street because of plowing. But because he knows Brian Albert and that he's a first responder, he decided not to call it in and have it towed. There are multiple Ford Edge cars in the Albert family. But there are also, I'm sure, Ford Edges all over town. And since it was never investigated, we'll never know whose car it was. The Canton Police Department and Massachusetts State Police never talked to Lucky. And in fact, Proctor wrote in a report that no one would have been plowing the road at that time. The first person to talk to Lucky was actually a defense private investigator. And he has consistently said there was nobody on the lawn. And when he passed by there later, there was a Ford Edge parked in front of the flagpole. He has been off a little on times, give or take an hour when doing estimates, but it's always been in the range of like 2:30 a.m. to 3:30 a.m., maybe 4 a.m. at the latest. And regardless of the time range, it was always a time when he was plowing and everyone was gone from 34 Fairview. And Brennan tried to pick holes in the timeline, but Yannetti allowed Lucky to clear that up. And it made him very relatable. But Brennan came out swinging after that regardless.
So why is it last year that you testified that it was 3 hours later, but you came up with the time of 5:30 as the final time?
As he's asking me these questions, I'm trying to do the math in my head. I'm sorry, math is not my strong suit.
You mentioned you're trying to do the math in your head. There is no reason why you would specifically remember certain times on each pass other than trying to remember and give an accounting, right?
Could you rephrase that, please?
Sure. You don't have your watch out on a certain schedule that you have to pass a certain street at a certain time.
Correct.
You aren't marking your times to some event when you were driving up and down the street that night, were you?
No.
So you're trying to go back with your memory and piece it together the best you can.
Correct.
And that's why you're giving estimates, yes?
Correct.
And when you spoke to those law enforcement officials, not Canton, not state police, and you said at 3 o'clock you saw first responder vehicles. That was based on your memory, wasn't it?
Objection.
It was based on your memory.
Not at 3:30.
Right. Do you know that there was a car similar to a Ford Edge in front of 34 Fairview around 6 a.m. that morning?
I wasn't able to get in front of Fairview Drive, 34 Fairview, at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Brennan also tried to bring up a dumpster that was in a driveway in the neighborhood to kind of test Lucky's memory, in a sense. In other words, if he didn't remember the dumpster, he couldn't have remembered other things that he saw that night. But what's so different about this, though, is that when something is out of the ordinary at a house that you've known the owner of your entire life, that's not the same as a random dumpster in someone's driveway. Especially because a body was found in the yard where he had seen something unusual. So, of course, that would stick out in a person's mind more. In addition to trying to trip Lucky up with the timeline, Brennan also introduced the theory that Lucky is only testifying the way he is because of Turtle Boy. He brought up, quote-unquote, the blogger, as in Turtle Boy or Aiden Carney, and asked Lucky about Turtle Boy threatening to expose him for something if he didn't tell law enforcement what he had already told the private investigator who contacted him. Now, Brennan also asked Lucky if the blogger he kept mentioning was on one side or the other, and he made it known he was in the courtroom. And Lucky stood firm through this. He said he's not being threatened, and he knew of the blog and the articles, but was dealing with the loss of his wife, and he wasn't paying close attention to the case at that time. Brennan continually asked him if he was threatened, almost as if he was trying to assign that feeling to him, despite Lucky denying it. Does Brennan think that tactic will help? If the jury knows there's a big following of people who think that Karen Reed is innocent, doesn't that look bad for the prosecution? And he mentions that Carney is in the room, so he can't be that threatened by Turtle Boy if he's in the room with him, right? Brennan also made a big deal about Lucky talking to an investigator on the same day that Turtle Boy's article came out. But after a court break, Brennan has to come back and admit that he was wrong. He was actually an entire year off, which is ironic since he had just spent all that time nitpicking Lucky's timeline for being off by 30 to 45 minutes. But Turtle Boy was actually in the courtroom during this entire exchange, which makes the whole thing seem more like fiction than an actual real trial. And even after all of that, Brennan continued to push and tried to imply that Lucky liked the attention that he got during the last trial and showed a picture with a supporter. Lucky gave the perfect response. He said he didn't ask for any of that. He was just doing his job. And no matter how much Brennan pushed, Yannetti cleared everything up in one question.
The questioning about the attention that you received in 2023 when the when you received secondhand the information from the blogger, was that before or long after you were interviewed and gave a statement to the defense investigator in February of 2022?
It was long after.
And that's all it takes. You can't convince a jury that a person's testimony is based on threats when they talked to a defense private investigator 2 weeks after John O'Keefe's death. And Turtle Boy's story didn't come out until more than a year after that. Another big favorite witness of the week was Karina Kolokithis. She was at the Waterfall Bar on January 28th when Karen and John O'Keefe got there. The defense called Karina to the stand because she's likable, she's relatable, and she gives a clear version of events that she saw on the night of January 28th. The thing about Karina that is unlike everyone else at the bar, she only drank water the entire time she was there, and she hadn't been drinking before she arrived. She testified that she talked to Karen almost the entire time that she was there, and she didn't seem intoxicated. Karina described a sweet moment between John O'Keefe and Karen where he kissed her on the forehead, and she said it was one of the sweetest things she's ever seen. But they showed a video of that moment, which had been captured on the bar's security camera. And the crazy part? The kiss happened directly in front of Brian Higgins, which actually kind of supports the defense's theory that Higgins may have kind of snapped about the whole thing. Karina also noted a moment between Jen McCabe and Karen as they were walking out of the bar, and Jen told Karen, "You're coming with me." And she found it odd, especially because the invite wasn't also extended to her. She said it was just very strange. Brennan asked very little on cross, and honestly, there's really nothing for him to get out of this witness. So he asked a few questions about John O'Keefe being a great guy, I think to kind of just remind the jury of that. The defense's case so far has been based on a few different things. One, that the Commonwealth's case is flawed and built on a flawed investigation. And because of this, the defense actually asked for the judge to reconsider her motion on allowing Easter to come in and testify about how an investigation should be run. And Judge Cannone smiled and said, "That's denied." They've also based their case on the fact that they say that there was no collision and that the police have ignored potential suspects and theories. Now, out of all of the defense's witnesses, the two that I think so far have been the worst for the Commonwealth's case are Dr. Russell and Officer Barrows. Dr. Russell, who has so much experience, said those wounds on John O'Keefe's arm are from a dog attack. And Barrows, who has zero connection with the case or the Canton Police Department, says Karen's smashed taillight did not look that way when they recovered it from her parents' house. So it's no surprise that these two were the witnesses that Brendan was the most aggressive and disrespectful to. So far, anyway, because Dr. Daniel Wolf from ARCA took the stand on Friday, and Brendan may have hit a new low with him. Wolf's testimony isn't done yet, so I'll include him in next week's episode. Karen said outside of court this week that she expects the defense to rest their case on Tuesday, June 10th. So we are getting to the final witnesses, the closers, the ones who are brought in to leave the jury with a lasting impression of reasonable doubt. And just a reminder, the only job of the defense is to show reasonable doubt. The burden of proof lies on the prosecution. And in next week's episode, we'll sum up the end of the defense's case. And you can decide what you think. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.